Well, the suspense is over for movie lovers. The Oscar nominations are out, and the Western adventure film, The Revenant, seems to be the one to catch, that is, for other nominees. The film leads the field with 12 Academy Award nominations. For those who don't know, The Revenant tells the true story of an 1820s fur trader expedition led by William Ashley. It's the story of survival for expedition member Hugh Glass after he was badly mauled by a bear, then left for dead by his colleagues. There's a strong Missouri and St. Louis connection, and to tell that part of the story, we've called in Dr. Jay Buckley, Associate Professor of History at Brigham Young University. His specialty is exploration of the American West. Professor, so nice to have you with us.
Thank you for the visit. I look forward to talking about Hugh Glass and the connection with St. Louis.
Have you seen the film?
I did see the film in preparation for our conversation.
And what do you think? Just a general review from you, if you would. Is it fairly factual, would you guess?
Well, yes and no. It does the thing that Hollywood is wont to do by taking a good story and embellishing it and changing it to suit their needs. But the element or the grain of truth about the bear story is certainly factual.
Well, I mentioned that Hugh Glass was mauled by a bear, and I guess that I have not seen the film yet, but I guess that triggers the entire story, his story for survival. Let's talk for a moment about the expedition or expeditions like this. There were many of them taking place at that particular time. The fur trade was very active, wasn't it?
Yes. When Lewis and Clark had gone on their expedition, they were amazed at the number of grizzly bear that they saw. I think in their journals, they count over 103 that they saw, and they ended up killing about 32. In fact, up by the Great Falls, they had so many encounters with bears that they actually declared war on the Grizzly Bear Nation, the only time they did so during their expedition. But they all confessed that once they had met them, they had earned their respect, and it was very difficult to kill them. So these stories of the bears came back with them when they returned to St. Louis in 1806. And within, by 1820 or so, there was two individuals, one named William Ashley, who was the lieutenant governor to Alexander McNair, the first state governor.
Of Missouri.
And yes. Mm-hmm. And he partnered up with Andrew Henry, who he had known through his saltpeter and lead mining operations, and together they advertised in the paper for enterprising young men that would ascend the Missouri River for 1, 2, or 3 years in order to hunt fur. And so these 100 men joined the expedition, and they traveled up the Missouri, and they arrived about where the Arikara villages are near the Grand River, where it forms its confluence with Yellowstone. And unfortunately, they had an incident where the Arikara attacked them. So they retreated downstream. They called upon General Henry Leavenworth to launch a punitive campaign. This is in the summer of 1823. And following that campaign in August, Andrew Henry heads out with a party to the west, and Jedediah Smith heads out on another party while Ashley returned to St. Louis to draw upon supplies to bring out the next year.
So was Ashley with or not with Hugh Glass?
He was not with him, okay. But his field partner, Andrew Henry, was. And so we actually have four main accounts of the Hugh Glass story. One is a member who was actually with the expedition, but he actually leaves us the briefest account. In his letter, this is Daniel Potts in 1824, who was there with Glass. He says, "One man was also torn nearly all to pieces by a white bear and was left by the way without any gun, who afterwards recovered." So that's the main primary account that we have of the incident. Although Glass survived the ordeal, and he told it to at least two different people, and James Clyman, another mountain man, and George Yunt, a trapper out of Taos, both give us longer accounts. And from watching the movie, I think they based the telling of the story on the George Yount account, which was one of the longest ones.
I'm always impressed in hearing about these expeditions of this kind, of the intrepid nature of the men who were part of them. I'm sure you've had that feeling, too, given your studies.
Yeah, when you study the fur trade, it was a difficult life, but it was a way that you could make a living. If you were successful and could avoid losing your furs in the river or being attacked by Indians or being killed by grizzlies or being frozen by Mother Nature, you could make a successful career of it. And William Ashley, that's the reason he got involved. As a politician, he wanted to make some cash so that he could run for governor. And later he served several terms as in the House of Representatives for the state of Missouri, as well as a run for Senate. He was defeated in both of his attempts to be governor of the state. But Ashley had a good vision, and basically what his idea was instead of focusing on forts along the river that Indians would bring the furs into, he would employ men to go into the Rocky Mountains and to trap. So in essence, he's replacing the Indians as the providers of the furs. And instead of forts where they would bring them in, he devised a rendezvous system where he would take out supplies and they would meet somewhere in the Rockies, usually in Utah, Idaho, or Wyoming, and exchange the furs for those goods to help the men stay out there another year. And thus these year-round mountain men, as we call them now, devolved from the system that Ashley and Henry put together.
Well, the fact that Ashley used all of this to raise money to run for political office would suggest to me that things haven't changed much in a couple of hundred years. You still need money to run, don't you?
You sure do. Yeah. And it was interesting that they called Glass an old man, and he was probably between the ages of 35 and 40. So you can imagine that probably most of the people were either from teenager to their 20s, but to refer to him as kind of the old man of the bunch at 35 or 40 let you know how dangerous and fatiguing some of these journeys were.
Yeah, life expectancy overall was probably not much more than about 45 or 50, I would guess, back in that day.
Right, that's true.
Yeah, let's talk about the St. Louis connection, because we want to connect the dots in that way. St. Louis was a part of the story, certainly as a fur trading town. That certainly was a big part of it. But was Glass from St. Louis?
Glass was from Pennsylvania. We don't know a lot about his life. His most famous incident is being mauled by a grizzly. But he did have some adventures. He was perhaps captured or lived with the Pawnee. I'm not sure about his whether he married and had a child. That's one of the main features of the film, is that his mixed ancestry son accompanies him on the expedition and plays a big part in the revenge tale. But other than that, we just know that he applied to this ad that he saw in the St. Louis, Missouri Intelligencer newspaper, and he joined this group that was going to be led by Henry, who was going to be the field agent for Ashley's party.
So obviously he did spend some time in St. Louis if he's reading a local paper and was recruited from here.
Right, and let's face it, by the time when Lewis and Clark get back in 1806, there are stories of all of the beaver that are available on the upper Missouri and on the Yellowstone immediately sparks interest. And so Manuel Lisa from St. Louis forms a party, the Missouri Fur Company, and William Clark is actually a silent partner in this venture, and they send up men up the river that next year and establish a fur trading fort on the Bighorn and Yellowstone rivers. So as early as 1807, St. Louis becomes this entrepot for the Americans. It had already been one for the French, of course, but its strategic location there near the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers made it ideal for this trading establishment. So St. Louis will kind of build its or cut its teeth on the fur trade, and a lot of its early industry is from the Chouteau family, who become very influential and significant in Missouri history, as well as the American Fur Company that has an office there, the Missouri Fur Company, and then a lot of private and smaller partnerships that form there as well.
And, of course, the first leg of the Oregon Trail is right in Missouri in the Kansas City area. That's and that was just getting rolling at about the same time.
Right, and in fact, that the fur trade made the Oregon Trail possible because as the annual fur caravans would leave St. Louis and they would travel to the Central Rockies, other groups of fur traders were coming from the Willamette Valley and the Hudson's Bay fort of Fort Vancouver up on the Columbia, and they would come to the Central Rockies. So when you connect those two dots, you've got a path now called the Great Fur Trade Road that goes from St. Louis to the Willamette Valley, and the fur traders know how to use it, and they become some of the early guides on the Oregon Trail.
Yeah. Let's bring it back here for the moment, because I want to get back to William Ashley and actually his journal, which still resides here, and the Campbell House. What's your connection to all of that?
Well, that's an amazing story. There are so many things from history that have been lost and forgotten, but occasionally something's uncovered. And in this case, William Ashley made two major trips to the Rocky Mountains, one in 1825 and one in 1826. And we had recovered his 1825 journal because he had given it after his death to one of his friends, William Sublette. And it was located in the Missouri Historical Society there on Skinker by Forest Park. And the 1826 journal, we were not aware of it and didn't know about it. Well, about 10 or 15 years ago, someone approached Andy Hahn, who's the director of the Campbell House Museum. Robert Campbell was one of the clerks in Ashley's company. And so, like Sublette, he had been given the 1826 journal for his private possession. For us, when we saw this journal, we weren't sure if it was Campbell's journal or if it was Ashley's journal. And so through handwriting experts and forensic science and assistance from a number of people, we were able to discern that this was Ashley's 1826 journal to the rendezvous in Cache Valley, Utah. So this was a great find, and we're able to piece together some of the incidences and the new routes that were made across Kansas and Nebraska that became part of the Oregon Trail. So these items of great historical significance occasionally do rise up, and we were able to publish that last year in the Rocky Mountain Fur Trade Journal. So it's a great find.
But the document itself is at the Campbell House still, is that not
correct? Yeah. The original is at the Campbell House Museum as part of the Robert Campbell collections.
Aside from the information with regard to routes to the West and that sort of thing, what other kinds of information would be included in the journal?
Well, we do have information on the kinds of equipment and accoutrements that were part of the fur trade, and so those are of value because these business records help us piece together both what it would take to outfit one of these expeditions, as well as the trading items that they were trading at various locations in the West with tribal people. And then we also can ascertain the routes by their descriptions of the geography, the rivers, the geographical prominences that they mention. And so we're able to recreate and retrace in a very precise way those routes. And so that's important because then later on we can see whether the trails, like the Oregon Trail and others, replicated those same routes. And in many cases, they're exactly the same location.
Was this information made available to other pioneers, if you will, or other expeditions, that information gleaned from one expedition could be useful to another? Was it made available to them?
Yes, but some of it was kept as proprietary information. For example, John Jacob Astor, he had sent some overland historians, and they had discovered South Pass, the pass through the Rocky Mountains. And he kept that proprietary information so that he was the only one who knew about it. Well, in 1824, Ashley's clerk, Jedediah Smith, rediscovers South Pass. And he writes back to Ashley and informs him that wagon travel would be feasible to cross the Rocky Mountains there. So that information became public knowledge, and within, 15 years, there will be dozens and dozens, soon hundreds and thousands of people who are taking that route. But the information is also being passed through newspaper accounts when expeditions are returning, or they talk about, I think in 1825 at the first rendezvous, Ashley made something like $65,000 to $70,000. Well, in 1825, that's a lot of money. I don't know the equivalent of in modern-day figures, but it was a killing.
It would be a lot.
So a lot of people are interested, yeah.
Well, there's a wonderful book, you're probably familiar with it, called Astoria, which tells the whole John Jacob Astor story, and a fascinating one it is. I can't think of the author. He was on the program a couple of months ago, but it's a great story. I want to thank you so much, Professor Jay Buckley, for being with us. This is fascinating stuff for history buffs and even for those who aren't. It's wonderful to hear about this part of our history and hear about the role that our community played in those early days. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and hopefully you can survive the bear attack.
We'll try to avoid that. Thank you.
All right.
Moving
care.
On, bye-bye. The St. Louis Symphony has something very special planned for this weekend. We'll have more on that in a moment. St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.